For as Richard has already said, this evening we start a new series, a series which has our mission in October particularly in mind. We thought at one stage of having a topical series in this build-up to our mission in October to try and encourage us in different aspects of taking the good news of Jesus Christ to the world. But we decided instead to opt for these two chapters, 2 Corinthians 4 and 5. Why? Because they centre on Paul's own ministry. That is the ministry of the gospel, the ministry of taking the good news to others. Because also, these two chapters give us an insight into what made Paul tick. The whole of 2 Corinthians is very realistic. It's realistic partly because Paul is having to defend himself. It seems that he was coming in for criticism. We don't know the precise nature of that criticism, but as a result of it, we get from him a glimpse into his own heart. Hence, the overall title of this series, Maintaining the Heartbeat. And we'll discover in the series that there are two sides to that. There's the negative side, as we will see how Paul kept going in the face of opposition and hardship. But there's also a positive side of how Paul learned to make his heart beat in time with the heartbeat of God. I don't know what it is about All Souls at the moment, but it seems to me, or maybe I'm just waking up to it, that there are a number of couples who seem to be in the first days of young love around the place just recently. You see it in their eyes down the Waldegrave Hall, sort of sitting looking dewy-eyed into one another's eyes. And you can almost hear the stereo effect of their hearts beating in time with one another. Mature love is slightly different. It's seen not so much in the eyes, but more in action. As a love which grows, learns to show itself in practice, in doing what pleases the other partner. And that was what was Paul's heartbeat. Paul's longing was that his heart should beat in time with the heartbeat of God. So chapter 5 and verse 9, he says, "So whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim to please him." Paul wanted his heart to beat in time with the heartbeat of God. Or chapter 5 and verse 14, "For the love of Christ controls us." I think we'll find as we study these chapters that they contain both encouragement and challenge. Encouragement, as we see that we are not the only ones who find it difficult to take the good news of Jesus Christ to other people. But challenge also, both as we look at Paul's own example and also as we learn about the very heartbeat of God himself. If you ask me which are the two greatest barriers to Christians getting involved in the work of taking the good news of Jesus Christ to others, very near the top of that list, I don't know if they be the top two, but very near the top, would come discouragement and also lack of vision or understanding of God. That is, there are some people in the Christian life who have gained a vision of God and of his concern for his world and have begun to take the good news of Jesus Christ to others. But then they've got discouraged. That's certainly been the story of certain parts and certain times of my Christian life. But there are others still who have never ever gained a vision of a God who is concerned for his world and those who are lost and in darkness. And there is no excuse for remaining either in the stuckness of discouragement or the darkness of no vision if we hear and heed the message of 2 Corinthians 4 and 5. And it's my earnest prayer that these studies will not just prepare us for our mission in October, although I very much hope they will. I hope they'll help us to get into gear for this time of special outreach which we've got coming up in October. But it is my prayer, and ours on the ministry team altogether, that for many it will set a new direction in our Christian lives, and for others it will serve as a strength and encouragement to maintain the heartbeat, to resynchronize our hearts so they beat in time with the heartbeat of God. That then by way of introduction. Our passage this evening begins with a recognition of the reality of discouragement. For Paul says here in chapter 4 and verse 1, "Therefore, having this ministry by the mercy of God, we do not lose heart." He repeats that in verse 16, "So we do not lose heart." Paul knew what it was to be tempted to lose heart. Paul knew what it was to get discouraged. We'll see much more of that next week. But here, as he makes just that reference, that aside to his discouragement, he shows how he coped with it and reveals, therefore, something of his own motivation. And that's the first thing I want us to look at, of the two things we'll look at this evening. The first is his motive, and his motive is the mercy of God. Verse 1, "Therefore, having this ministry by the mercy of God, we do not lose heart." Why is it that he didn't lose heart? It was because he knew that he had been given the ministry of taking the good news of Jesus Christ to others by the mercy of God. And it was that understanding of God's mercy which was the key to his motivation. It led him, first of all, to a tremendous sense of privilege. And it seems to me is the feel of verse 1. It is a verse which reflects a great sense of privilege. We have this ministry by the mercy of God. It is a tremendous privilege to have this ministry. The background of this verse, the therefore at the beginning, refers back to chapter 3, in which Paul has been contrasting the ministry of Moses and the law with the ministry of the gospel of Jesus Christ and the Spirit. And he says that the ministry of Moses led people into bondage. It led them to the situation where they could not be free. But the ministry of the gospel brings people into freedom, because it is the ministry of the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. And his conclusion is that to be entrusted with a ministry that leads people into true freedom is a tremendous privilege. To be given, as he calls it in verse 4, the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the likeness of God, to be entrusted with that light is a tremendous privilege. We all know, and we will be reminded many, many more times over the next fortnight, that the Olympic Games start very soon. The flame is already on its way. And that torch, I don't know how they select the people who carry the Olympic flame, but one thing I do suspect is that there are not many people who turn the opportunity down. There are not many people, I suspect, who are asked and say, "Well, no thanks, don't particularly feel like it. Can't be bothered." Because surely for an athlete there can be no greater privilege than to carry the Olympic flame. Surely for the Christian there can be no greater privilege than to be entrusted with the light of the gospel, of the glory of Christ, who is the likeness of God. We have this ministry by the mercy of God. How different Paul's attitude is, I think, so often from our own. You see, often we do not have a sense of privilege when we think of the task of taking the good news to others, but more a sense of burden. We see the call to take the good news to others as something additional, lumped onto us as Christians. We find it hard enough to be Christians anyway, to try and lead lives that please God, to try and do the things and think the things and say the things that we ought to. We find that hard enough, and then someone says we've got to do this as well. At least that's how it seems to us. But it didn't seem like that to Paul. And maybe that was because he looked less at the difficulties and at the opposition than at the glory of the message that he'd been given, the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the likeness of God. This service that we celebrate tonight, the Holy Communion, reminds us of all that God did in showing his mercy to us in Jesus Christ. It reminds us of the wonder of forgiveness. It reminds us of the cost to God in Jesus Christ when he suffered and died for us. It reminds us of the heart of the message reminds us therefore of the privilege of being entrusted with the ministry of taking that message to others. An understanding of the mercy of God leads us, as it led Paul, to a sense of privilege, but also to a sense of wonder. Because if a sense of privilege is what marks verse 1, it seems to me that it is a sense of wonder that marks verse 6. And the motivation of Paul almost acts as a sort of sandwich to this passage, this short passage that we're studying tonight. Look for a moment at verse 6. "For it is the God who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' who has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ." Paul had a real sense of wonder concerning what had happened to him. And that wonder came not just from the fact that it had happened, but because he understood what had happened. And therefore he saw the true worth of all that he had been given. So he can say in verse 7, "We have this treasure in earthen vessels." He knew the full value and the full wonder of all that he had been given in Jesus Christ. I remember reading some time ago in the papers the story of a painting which had been in someone's attic for a long time. It had been sent when they wanted to clear out, they were moving house or whatever, and they sent it off to an auction room and it fetched what they thought was quite a reasonable price. But what turned out to be very cheap, because it was discovered later by another auction house that it was actually a masterpiece by some painter, I must say I'd never heard of, but somebody had, and they paid a great deal of money for it. Because suddenly someone realized its true worth. And Paul understood the true worth and wonder of all that he had been given in Jesus Christ. Sadly, I think many of us have either never understood it, or we've lost sight of the wonder of all that God has done in our own lives and of what he has given to us in Jesus Christ. And that, I think, is the reason why for many of us we are not that concerned for our friends who do not know Christ, from the people we stand next to in the tube, the people we work with, the people we know, our families. Because we've lost sight of the wonder of all that God has done for us in Jesus Christ. But it was this understanding, it was this sense of wonder that was one of the mainsprings of Paul's motivation. Let's look a bit more closely at verse 6, because I think it's so important. "For it is the God who said, 'Let light shine out of darkness,' who has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ." Notice it's God's initiative. It's God who said, and God who has shone. Notice too the extraordinary parallel between the creation of the world and the new creation of each individual Christian. It is the God who said, "Let light shine out of darkness." When did he say that? Right at the foundation of the world. It's that same God, that same great creator God, who has shone in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God. But not this time to give physical light, but to give spiritual light. The light that leads to the knowledge of the glory of God. To anyone with any knowledge of the Old Testament, to know the glory of God is the greatest knowledge man can have. There's no greater knowledge to be found at Oxford, at Cambridge, at Yale, or Harvard, or the Sorbonne. There is no greater knowledge anywhere to be found than the knowledge of the glory of God. And that is what God has shone in our hearts. And where is it to be found? It is found in the face of Christ. Now it's easy to see parallels between what Paul describes here and his own experience on the Damascus Road when he saw that blinding light and his own life was turned around in such a dramatic fashion. But it's easy too to think, well, my conversion wasn't like that. When I became a Christian, it didn't happen like that. But Paul is not talking about the manner of his conversion. Rather, here he's talking about the true nature of all conversion. Because he says here that God has shone in our hearts. Everyone who has heard and received the gospel of Jesus Christ and turned to Christ can say these words of verse 6 for themselves. I can say it for myself. It is the God who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," who has shone in my heart to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. And if you have turned to Christ in response to the gospel and repentance and faith, then you too can say that verse for yourself. And when we say it, and when we think about it, is it possible not to join Paul in his sense of wonder? But I don't think we would often describe our conversion in such terms. You see, the way we talk about things and the way Paul talks about them, again, are rather different. You see, we normally start with the word I. I became a Christian. I turned to Christ. I gave my life to Christ. I opened the door to Christ. I committed my life. But we start with the word I. Paul says, it was God who has shone in our hearts. And I wonder, I only wonder, I'm not sure, but I wonder if that difference is significant. I wonder if we think to ourselves, well, I've done quite a lot for God already. After all, I've given up what I used to be. I've already turned around. I've started to come to church. I've done this. I've done that. Why should I do one more thing? That is, take the good news of Jesus Christ to others. But Paul thought to himself, no, God has done everything. God sent his Son. God shone his light into my heart. God has done all that. And now God has given me the ministry of taking this light to others. How can I not fulfill that ministry? That's Paul's thinking. But whether there is truly a significance in the difference in thinking there, it is certain that Paul's sense of wonder was one of his main motives in taking the gospel to others. And if we are to begin or to continue in the work of taking the good news to others, that sense of wonder must be one that we share. Now, before we move on to think of Paul's method and message is the second thing I want us to look at this evening, I just want to say that I cannot overstress the importance of the right understanding of who we are as Christians and of what God has done for us as Christians if we are ever to engage in the ministry which Paul engaged in of taking the good news to others. For if we do not see who we are as Christians and why we are what we are as Christians, that it's all tied up with the good news itself, then we will never have any desire to pass on that good news to others, nor any ability to keep going when it gets difficult, as it will do, when we get discouraged, as we will do. Therefore, may I suggest that as tonight the elements of bread and wine are passed along our rows and we take them in our own hands, we actually say again to ourselves tonight as we take those elements, he did this for me. This bread, this wine is to me a symbol of all that God has done for me. And it's not really about what I've done, it's about what he's done. And in his mercy, he's not only done that, but he's given me the privilege of being able to take his mercy, the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, to others. And when we do that, we begin to learn what it means for our hearts to beat in time with the heartbeat of God. Let's move on then, more briefly, to look at Paul's method and message. If his motive was the mercy of God, his method and his message are the open statement of the truth. I tried when preparing this sermon to separate out the method and the message. It seemed like a good idea to come up with a nice, neat three-point sermon. Nice three M's, two, motive, method, message, get three separate points, but I couldn't separate the last two out. It seemed to me that they're so closely tied together in Paul's thinking here that you cannot actually completely separate them out. Of course, there is a distinction, but the distinction is small, and the thing that Paul is trying to teach you is the two things are very closely tied together. I'm not sure I go entirely as far as the man who said that the medium is the message, but it's certainly true that the method must match the message. That is, the method by which we pass on the good news must match the message of the good news itself, especially if that message is the truth. On my holidays, I was reading two or three novels, and one was a political novel about, entirely fictitious, of course, about a Prime Minister of Canada and his struggle to maintain power and his use of power. And of course, if power is the goal, then almost anything goes when it comes to methods. But if truth is the goal, then any falsehood in our method is going to detract from our aim. For if we seek to promote the truth in any way that is not true, then we detract and take away from the truth. That is, of course, the nonsense of Pravda, the Soviet newspaper. Truth. In Russian, it calls itself. And yet we all know that it's not a standard bearer of truth, but a fabricated tissue of lies, because the method in which it's put together is wholly untrue. Paul says, in contrast, our methods are to be transparent, so that the message can be clearly seen. Negatively, verse 2, that means we have renounced disgraceful, underhanded ways. Literally, the hidden ways of shame. It means we refuse to practice cunning or guile or the sleight of hand of the magician who makes you look one way while he does something in another place that you're not aware that he's doing. It means refusing to tamper with God's word. In Paul's book, the end most certainly does not justify the means. Now, that does not mean we should go in for totally unattractive presentations of the good news. Doesn't mean we should not think of ways in which we can present the good news, which is attractive and relevant. My wife Penny, when she first started her business, got a magazine called Winning Customers. And one of the first articles I remember her reading and telling me about concerned the use of what they called dead cow words. What they meant by that was the nice meal I had out last week, sitting out in the open. Very difficult to imagine now, isn't it? Out in the open, even in my shorts, late in the evening, it's very warm. There I was, and I ate what they called on the menu, medallion of fillet of beef in Roquefort sauce. In dead cow language, that means slices of dead cow in moldy, curdled milk. Because, you see, we always present a message in a package, in a method. There has to be a method. There has to be a way of presenting a message. And Paul is not saying we should seek to do it in the most boring and dull way possible. But he is saying we should reject anything that would detract from the truth. So important and so precious is the truth that there must be no false pretenses, no cunning or guile, no hidden ways of shame. So when we invite people to things in October, there's no pretending that they're coming to one thing when actually they're coming to another. If they're coming to a meeting at which the gospel is going to be explained, they need to be told that. The invitation needs to say, please come to my flat next Tuesday evening. A group of us are getting a group of friends together, and we're going to have a discussion about Christianity led by a member of our church. Make it crystal clear. Do please come with me to church on Sunday night. We've got a special event on in our church at the moment. It's called Whatever Happened to God? And we're looking at what different people think about God and what place God has in our lives. Do come. But make it clear. No false pretenses. Come along. We've got a lovely orchestra. Oh, by the way, there's a preacher, but don't tell anybody about that. We have got a lovely orchestra. No harm in telling them that as well. But make it crystal clear. No cunning. No false pretenses, no editing of the message. The message is clear. Verse 5, what we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord. That is the open statement of the truth. The message is about Jesus, and it's about Jesus as Lord. And therefore a Jesus who demands a response, not just a Jesus who wants to give us a cuddle. It's a Jesus who demands that we acknowledge him as Lord. It means through no bowing to pressure for success. You see, Paul was prepared to stick by his method and his message, despite the criticism that he faced. As I mentioned earlier, we don't know the precise nature of that criticism, but we do know he was getting it in the neck. And it seems that one of the things he might have been held up for was that he wasn't successful enough, that there were other preachers around who got better results than he did. Look to my Sunday Times today, briefly after lunch, and I was just reading the sports pages where I normally turn first, and saw on the back page an article slating poor Peter May, the chairman of our cricket selectors. Turned over on the inside page, and there was an article saying that Bobby Robson, our football manager, should be sacked as well. Who'd be in public life? But Paul was getting it in the neck as well. We don't know precisely for what, but he was getting it. And it seems here that as he defends himself, and particularly as he explains in verses 3 and 4, the nature of the opposition of the God of this world, that it may be he was being criticized for not being successful enough. And so he finds it necessary to tell them that even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled only to those who are perishing. In their case, he says, the God of this world has blinded the minds of the unbelievers to keep them from seeing the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the likeness of God. He says, in other words, there is bound to be opposition, and you cannot criticize me for not being successful 100% of the time, because there is real opposition from the God of this world. And as we go into October, as we go into this next year of mission with Billy Graham coming next summer, and as we begin to see that actually our lifetimes as Christians are to be lifetimes of outreach, we too need to recognize that we have opposition from the God of this world. But we need to recognize too that there will be pressure on us for success. For the world is very success orientated, and the church has very often followed suit. The extreme example is, of course, the TV evangelists. But we are, I don't think, terribly close to that. But we do need to keep our eyes open for the same dangers. For it is an easy trap to fall into, to try and make success happen. To try and make people respond to the gospel by changing it or by altering the packaging. And we need to be very careful, even this October, in our own mission of how we go about this. You see, we're running a number of different events. Some of them will be events which are clearly involved in the open statement of the truth. But others won't be. And we need to be clear what our reasons are for doing those other sorts of events. And we need always to ask two important questions about any method of telling the good news to others. Any method of seeking to reach out. And with these two questions, I close. And the first question is this: where does my confidence lie? If I want my friend to come to know the glory of God in the face of Christ as I have, where does my confidence lie for that to happen in his or her life? For Paul, the answer was clear. His confidence lay in the truth, in the message of Jesus Christ as Lord, the message that God had entrusted to him, in the ministry that God had given to him. But maybe we've organized an event coming up this October, which is not specifically an event at which there will be the open statement of the truth. Well, that's great, but it's great only as long as we are clear that that is no substitute for the open statement of the truth. That it has no value unless it is seen as part of a process. That it's a good place to begin. And many of us need to begin to build bridges towards our friends and those who don't yet know Christ. But there's no point in building bridges unless we're going to cross them. And we need to recognize that. Our ultimate aim must be in having these bridge meetings that one day there will be a second occasion, maybe one-to-one, maybe at another meeting, at which we will then engage in the open statement of the truth. For that must be where our confidence lies. That must be the only way in which people will respond to Jesus Christ. That's the first question there. Where does my confidence lie? And the second is, does what I'm doing as an individual or what we're doing as a group or as a church clarify or obscure the truth? You see, Paul was very concerned that all he did could be read like an open book, that all he did would be transparent. So we've thought already, we can't avoid packaging the message. But we must ask, does the packaging clarify and seek, and does it help people to see the message, or does it detract from the message? You see, sometimes the packaging can be so wonderful that we never bother to look inside. You know, when you go to a department store, they wrap up a lovely package for you. You go and give it to someone, they say, well, this is such a lovely package, I'm not sure I really want to take the wrappers off. It's been so beautifully tied up. And there can be a danger of that if we're not careful. Take, for instance, drama and music. Now, I'm a great fan of both in seeking to communicate the good news to others. We're saying goodbye to Neil Nichols, and one of the things Neil has brought to us over this year has been his talents in the area of drama, both in writing sketches and acting them with his accomplice back here, Ian Bentley. We're also aware of the tremendous depth of talent we have in the area of music as a church. Both can be a tremendous help to preparing people to hear the open statement of the truth. But neither is the open statement of the truth. And we must get that crystal clear in our minds. The open statement of the truth must mean the clear presentation of Jesus Christ as Lord. Maybe publicly, through preaching, maybe privately, one-to-one in conversation, maybe through a book, but some way in which it is clearly presented so that it can be followed and to which people can respond. And that is our business this October and beyond. It's not an easy business, as we'll see in particular in next week's passage. But if we are to do it, our motivation must be right. We must regain that sense of privilege and that sense of wonder that we've been given this ministry by the mercy of God. That comes when we recognize that God has shone in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. And when we recognize that, we will seek to take that message out to our friends. And not only to take it, but to take it in such a way as will make it crystal clear. To take it in such a way that nothing will detract from the purity and the glory of that message we've had entrusted to us. May God help us in that task.